Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ernest Cline's debut novel, Ready Player One, was a New York Times bestseller in 2012. The film version of that novel is being directed by Steven Spielberg. Cline returns now with a new 80s nostalgic video game-themed thriller entitled Armada. Armada tells the story of Zach Lightman. He knows that in the real world, aimless teenage gamers with anger issues don't get chosen to save the universe, and then he sees the flying saucer. Again, the title of the novel is Armada. It's a pleasure to welcome Ernest Cline to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
It is very nice to have you here. We had you on for the first novel. It's great that you're back. When we were talking about the first novel, what were your expectations? What did you think the audience for that book would be?
You know, I was not sure at all. When you write your first novel, they tell you to write what you know and write the book that you've always wanted to read. So I was just trying to do that, see if I could write a novel and try to write a story that would please myself. So I wasn't sure what the expectations would be. I wasn't sure I could even get a book like that published. I wasn't sure you could have Mechagodzilla fight Ultraman and not get sued. And I wasn't sure, you know, that the book would work for anybody who wasn't alive in the 80s, much less in other countries. But the reaction stunned me. You know, the book has been published in over 20 languages, and it's been selected at over a dozen universities as a common read for incoming freshmen who weren't even alive in the 80s. So it ends up being like a primer on past pop culture for them.
But obviously, there was a great nostalgic chord that was there for people who did grow up in the 80s, and like myself, who read this book, and it was just delightful to read about these remnants of your childhood.
Yes, well, and it was, you know, I just thought I was writing about my childhood in this small town in Ohio that I grew up in, Ashland. But I've since, you know, discovered that I was writing about everyone's childhood, not just in America, but all around the world. By the 80s, we all had the same, you know, stores in our shopping mall, the same songs on our radio, the same movies in our theater, the same textbooks in our school a lot of times. So just writing about my childhood, which I thought was kind of isolated, ended up being kind of a mirror image of a lot of people's childhood, which has really surprised me. And then I think, you know, for readers who weren't alive during that time, it ends up just working as a fun action-adventure story. And the 80s pop culture is like the ancient mythology in an Indiana Jones movie. You know, you may not know whether it's true, or but you know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
So how did all of that lead to Armada?
Well, it was I was so you know, stunned by the success of Ready Player One that it was kind of hard to get back to that place of just trying to please myself and not thinking about the audience that I had now developed, and just trying to write a story that would appeal to me. But I feel like I managed to do that, and I went back to, you know, the things that inspired me when I was young and the things that set me on the path to being a writer, primarily seeing Star Wars when I was 5 years old and playing Space Invaders, my first video game, when I was about 6 years old, which I think I ended up playing for the first time right after I'd seen Star Wars for the second or third time. So early video games and early video game culture is forever intermingled in my mind with Star Wars. And I've since found out that during my research for Armada that a lot of early video games, Space Invaders, Asteroids, Defender, they were all inspired by the earliest game developers who went and saw Star Wars and tried to recreate that feeling in their earliest video games. But one of the primary inspirations for me in writing Armada was something that really happened back in 1981 that I remember reading about. Atari put out a video game called Battlezone, which was like a tank shoot-'em-up game. But it was so realistic that the U.S. Army saw its potential as a training simulator, and they purchased it and had the original Atari programmer reprogram it into a game called Bradley Trainer, and it wasn't actually a game. It was a fighting simulator to teach soldiers to operate the new Bradley fighting vehicle. When I read about that, it just really set my imagination on fire. The idea that, because it was part of a fantasy I think I'd had ever since I played my first video game. Like, what if this was real? What if all these hard-won video game skills that I had been accruing my whole life had real-world value? And then a few years later, after I heard about Battlezone, then I saw The Last Starfighter, which is one of my favorite movies. I was always disappointed there was never a video game tie-in for that book. And then Ender's Game, another one of my favorites. Novels, which also explores the idea of video games being used as a training simulator. But, I didn't want to just rehash those stories. And what kind of inspired me to write Armada, spent a couple of years writing it, was two, I think, unique innovations in technology that have recently come about, both the rise of drones, the use of drones in our military, and also the idea of using quantum data teleportation to control these drones without radio, so you could actually control them instantaneously over vast distances without any lag. Like our probe that we sent to Pluto, we have to wait for radio signals to get out there and get back, so we can't control it directly. But the idea of using, lossless data teleportation controls to control drones really excited me. And once I had that idea, it occurred to me that my brother's a Marine, and he's an explosive ordnance disposal technician, and they use drones to disarm bombs. And their video game controllers that they use to operate them look like PlayStation and Nintendo controllers, the same with a lot of our aerial drones. So when I had the idea of all the video gamers of Earth using their Xboxes and PlayStations and Nintendos to control drones to fight off an alien invasion, and then the alien invaders would also be using drones, it would be a sort of a video game war where the outcome was decided by the gaming skills of these two different civilizations. And as soon as I had that idea, I latched onto it, and it got me really excited because it was something that I'd never seen, in Star Wars or Last Starfighter or Ender's Game. When I watch Star Wars now, I actually wonder whether or not using drones when they go to blow up the Death Star, they're sending poor pilots in there to sacrifice themselves. But if you can have real-time holographic phone calls between planets, then you can probably also control drones, have remote control X-Wings and TIE fighters. So all of that kind of gets mashed up into Armada.
Certainly one of the movies that I thought of from my youth in reading this novel was War Games with Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, War Games is anyone who's read Ready Player One knows of my love of War Games. Part of that story is one of the characters have to reenact the movie word for word. I'm a huge fan of Kids Can Do Anything movies, which was had its golden age in the 80s, I think. War Games, a kid's just trying to download some games and he accidentally starts World War III and then prevents it. I'm also a big fan of The Goonies. Kids find a treasure map and that leads to pirate treasure and save their town from foreclosure. Another huge movie for me, along with The Last Starfighter, is this somewhat more obscure movie called Iron Eagle, which is about a kid who learns to fly an F-16 by cutting class to sneak into a flight simulator, which is just a really advanced video game, and then ends up, acquiring the skills to become a real pilot. And that was one of my favorite movies as a kid. So all those kind of stories about, which all kind of follow the Joseph Campbell monomyth, the hero's journey. It's always a young person who's called out of their average day-to-day life and to save the world or save their world.
It is fascinating in reading Armada, too, and I'll just take this quick diversion, and that is there are many references to movies, of certainly Last Starfighter and as well as the Star Wars franchise, but also many of the films of Steven Spielberg, who now is going to be is directing Ready Player One. That must be so surreal for you.
It is the most surreal thing that's ever happened to me. I often tell people that I feel like I'm the character in Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge or Vanilla Sky, that I died a few years ago and I've been making this all up in my head. Because, I drive a DeLorean, which comes directly from my childhood love of Back to the Future,
right,
which Steven Spielberg produced. And,
sure.
And the main character in Ready Player One carries a Grail diary through the entire story, trying to solve the puzzles because he's such a fan of the Indiana Jones trilogy. So now that the gentleman who made all the Indiana Jones movies is going to make my movie, my first novel, is stunning to me. I believe he's only ever adapted someone's first novel into a film once before, and that was Jaws by Peter Benchley. So I'm just in incredibly good company.
Do you know how it came onto his radar?
The book started out as a New York Times bestseller, and then in paperback had an even bigger fan base. And I'm not sure. I think Warner Brothers, he hasn't made a movie with Warner Brothers, who bought the film rights, since AI back in 2001. And so he was interested in it enough to return to Warner Brothers and partner up with them. It's just, I'm just overwhelmed even talking about it. It seems so surreal to me. It is, it is a dream come true.
So where are we in the process?
I think they're starting to do preliminary casting and pre-production this fall, and then they would hopefully shoot the film next year, and then it might come out the following year in 2017, which is crazy.
And then as far as the screenwriting, was that something you wanted to do?
It was. You know, I started out as a screenwriter. I wrote I've only had one film produced, a movie called Fanboys, which is about Star Wars fans who are breaking into Skywalker Ranch to see a new Star Wars movie early. And that was the first real screenplay that I ever wrote. And it got, you know, got produced by the Weinstein Company. And it was has Captain Kirk and Princess Leia and Lando are all make cameos in it. So, but that movie took 10 years to get made, and it was heavily warped and changed in the process. And that was actually what prompted me to want to write fiction as opposed to screenwriting, which was my first passion. And when I was writing Ready Player One, you know, I assumed it could never be a movie, and it was actually kind of freeing when I was writing it, you know, because I wasn't sure that any of these pop culture references, and, you know, if you made the movie, then you would have to get license permission for all of that. But, you know, what's the strange thing that's happened now is I think the one director who could get permission for pretty much anything now is going to be the director. I would always use Who Framed Roger Rabbit as an example of like a perfect storm of licensing, but he's the guy who made that happen. He got all those different animation. He has Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse dancing together in the same scene, and that, you know, Steven Spielberg made that happen. And also Warner Brothers recently made the Lego movie, which mashes up a bunch of different properties. So I think there's a good chance that there's a perfect storm and Ready Player One could end up being just as I envisioned it when I was writing a novel. And I was able to write the first few drafts of the screenplay. It was part of the option agreement for the film rights. And it's since been rewritten and developed further. And the gentleman working on it right now, Zach Penn, who wrote The Last Action Hero and a bunch of the X-Men films, and he's a friend of mine. So he still kept me really included in the process. So I feel really lucky.
Ernest Cline is the author of Ready Player One and the new novel Armada, which is out from Crown. Just want to read a little bit from the beginning of Armada, where Zach is talking and saying, I had been spending way too much time playing video games lately, especially Armada. I played it every night and all day on the weekends. I'd even ditched school a few times to play elite missions on servers in Asia that were scheduled in the middle of the day over here. Clearly, I had been overdoing it for some time now, but that was easy enough to remedy. I would just go cold turkey for a while to clear my head. Sitting there in the dusty attic, I made a silent vow to quit playing Armada entirely for 2 full weeks. No gamer, no video game fan that I know hasn't had that moment where they said, okay, this is starting to take over my life. I have to remove myself from this.
It's true. You know, that was something I delved into in my research for Ready Player One is video game addiction, which was on the rise even back in the late 90s. And I think the more realistic video games become, the more of a problem it is. And, you know, countries like South Korea, where video game culture is pervasive, they have a problem with people dropping dead from malnutrition because they forget to feed their physical bodies because they are so wrapped up in this alternate life. So that was, you know, when I saw The Matrix, that was part of the idea for Ready Player One. It occurred to me that, you know, we wouldn't create machines that would enslave us. If we had a virtual reality that was even better than our real reality, that humanity might retreat into it en masse, you know, and to flee the real world. And then the real world would get even worse from neglect. And that's, you know, that's something I think everybody has that love-hate relationship with. Or love-fear relationship with escapism. You know, you can take any form of escapism too far. And as video games get more real, you know, and feel more like real life, going down that rabbit hole seems easier and easier.
When you look at that character of Zach, how would you describe him?
I tried to the character's name is Zach Lightman, and the last name Lightman is actually the same last name as Matthew Broderick's character in War Games, which, you know, and there was a lot of little references like that to my favorite film. But I try to do kind of that 80s young hero archetype, but also just make him sort of an amalgam of all the different diehard gamers that I know. I used to be among their number, but as I've gotten older and become a parent, I have less time to spend video games. And it's very dangerous for me as well. Playing video games is ostensibly research. But I can, you know, spend all my time doing research and never actually write. But yeah, so I just tried to imbue him with everything that I know about gamer culture and the people who love video games and also, you know, walk that line of having an alternate life. I have so many friends who, you know, they work their day job and have their their real career, and then at night they become a barbarian or a space fighter, or, you know, lead a whole other existence in this online virtual world. And with the, you know, upcoming advent of virtual reality and the Oculus Rift and all the different VR platforms that are about to land, I feel like that kind of alternate life will, a lot of people, you know, will be drawn into it even more. It's not living through this two-dimensional gaming screen like we have through the whole history of video games. Now video games will be, you know, 360 degrees and immersive completely.
When you think of both Armada and Ready Player One as science fiction novels, have you been tempted to add a degree of fantasy?
Yeah, well, I'm a child of Star Wars, and I love Star Wars, which a lot of people would classify as more space fantasy or space opera as opposed to science fiction. But I'm also grew up reading Heinlein Juvenal's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress and Have Spacesuit Will Travel. I just devoured, you know, spacefaring adventure stories like that, which ended up leading to my, you know, interest in real science, and Carl Sagan played a big role in that. And so for me to suspend my disbelief as a writer and a reader, it always helps if there's some real science, not too much, you know, not hard science and long equations about orbital mechanics, but just enough science for me to know that the writer is aware of science, and even if you disregard it, I always think of that Arthur C. Clarke quote, any significantly advanced technology will be indistinguishable from magic. And that's how it is for us now. You know, our cell phones, our mobile phones are magic, but we just take them for granted. But, you know, they keep us connected to everyone all around the world all the time, and we're all tethered to it, and we can have access to the entire collected information and history of human civilization in our pocket. It's magic, but it's real. So that's how I view technology. You can kind of use technology to do the same thing as you can in magic in a story.
There is a bit of a romantic plot line in the book between Zach and the character Lex, and I'm just curious as to how natural that was in the writing of it. Just seemed like it was needed, or was it something that was an homage to something like War Games and the Ally Sheedy character in that film?
There was a little bit of that. There's always a great, I always love those films where there's a strong male character, but also a strong female character that ends up almost like films like War Games. And also there's another movie that's always reminds me of that, The Manhattan Project, which is about a kid in Ithaca, New York in the 80s who finds out that there's a nuclear weapons plant run by John Lithgow outside his small town, and he breaks in and steals some plutonium and then makes a nuclear weapon for his science fair to prove a point. But there's a great female character that kind of helps him. And in most of these stories, I'm also heavily influenced by James Cameron's films. He always takes pains to have a really strong female character who's central to the plot. And I have a daughter, and I know someday she's going to read my books, and I want her to see herself represented in my stories. And I like women who kick ass.
that's the really gets down to the
heart,
bottom
the heart of it.
Absolutely. At the end of the book, there is a mixtape, and I just am curious. So for people who are looking at this, it is a Maxell cassette tape, and it has where you would, you know, put down your list of songs that so many of us did growing up in that time. Is this something that you created for the book, or was this something that you actually, the Raid the Arcade mix, was this something that you had actually done specifically?
Well, you know, it was a combination of the two. My brother, who's a major in the Marine Corps, who the book is dedicated
right.
to, he actually created that mixtape for me because his handwriting, he would always make these really elaborate mixtape covers, and his handwriting was much better and more legible than mine. And since the book was dedicated to him, I asked him to do that. But yeah, that was such a central part of my gaming experience and that early arcade culture of going in and you would make a special mixtape with all your favorite songs to go in and when you're playing in the arcade or at home. And it's also a little bit of an homage to Iron Eagle. A lot of the songs on that mixtape are from the Iron Eagle soundtrack. There's a few from Top Gun there as well. But one of my favorite things about Iron Eagle is that the character who learns to fly an F-16 by sneaking into the flight simulator at his father's Air Force base, he always takes his Walkman in there because it's like a video game, and he has to listen to Queen or Twisted Sister while he's playing, or it throws off his rhythm. So later on, when he goes to rescue his dad with Lou Gossett Jr., he's got to have, you know, the music of King Cobra and Queen blasting, or he can't fly or can't do his mission. So I always loved that, and it was such, you know, reminded me so much of my own gaming experience that I wanted to weave that into the story. And another kind of fun thing with that mixtape that I actually haven't mentioned in any interviews yet is there's the exact same number of tracks for each chapter. So there's like a song for each chapter, and I tried to make the songs kind of match up to the theme of each chapter. I don't know if anybody's noticed that yet.
But oh, wow. That's really cool. Yeah. With that in mind, would you listen to music when you were writing?
I would stop and listen to songs sometimes, but usually for me to write, I need to be listening to film scores or something orchestral that doesn't have lyrics, because lyrics tend to distract me. But I listened, in fact, to some of the Basil Polidorus score for Iron Eagle while I was writing Armada, along with, you know, some John Williams and other favorites. But yeah, usually stuff without lyrics.
You mentioned the DeLorean. How did you come to acquire a DeLorean?
Well, thank you for that question. It's a business expense. I had always wanted to own a DeLorean. Yeah. I saw one at a science museum in Columbus, Ohio in 1982, right? The year they stopped making them, it was the car of the future back then. And I just fell in love with it. And then a few years later, when it was featured in Back to the Future, one of my favorite movies of all time, I just I loved it even more. And I knew that I wanted to own one someday. But it always seemed like wanting to own, you know, Kit from Knight Rider or Magnum P.I.'s Ferrari, something that was ridiculous and would never happen. But when I sold Ready Player One and sold the film rights in 48 hours, unexpectedly, that my whole life changed, and I realized I was going to get to go on a book tour and need to have an author photo taken. And it occurred to me I could finally buy a DeLorean and I could use it in my author photo, which would be kind of perfect because my book was sort of an 80s time machine, just like the DeLorean, and that I could also take it on my book tour, which would make me a lot more interesting if I showed up in a time machine. And then my dream car would end up being a business expense. And so, and it clearly is. We're talking about it right now. It's selling books right now. There's no denying that it's not just a giant toy that I play with to avoid writing.
And you ended up with another one, which you ultimately gave to your brother.
It's true. You know, I bought a second DeLorean as the grand prize for a contest that I held. When the paperback for Ready Player One came out, I held a contest with Three Keys and Three Gates that was run online to help promote the paperback and kind of bring the book to life. And I gave away a DeLorean. I bought another DeLorean off of eBay to give away as a grand prize because I knew I could never give mine away. I'd already become too attached to it. But then the gentleman who won the contest a few years after he won it contacted me and said, you know, my family's run up some medical bills, and this is a way for me to pay them off if I sell this car, which I hate to do, but he wanted to see if I wanted to buy it back. And I didn't want it to end up with somebody who didn't know, you know, the history of the car, and I'd driven it on my paperback tour. So, but I also didn't want to own two DeLoreans because that's just seems too greedy. I was ashamed to tell people that I had. It's like owning two Lamborghinis or something. So I did also, you know, and I wanted to keep it in the family. And my brother is, you know, a combat veteran and 20 years in the Marine Corps and is, you know, been awarded medals. And he, but no one treats him like the rock star that he is until I gave him the DeLorean. And now everybody treats him, you know, like that's the thing about the car. The car is famous and everybody has a fond association with it from their childhood. So when you drive a DeLorean, you end up, it ends up turning you into a rock star. And my brother is a rock star. So and it's so much fun. The cars are 30 years old and entropy is taking over and they're both breaking down. So now we can give each other tips on keeping our 30-year-old Irish-made sports cars running.
I was going to ask you, are they nice cars to ride in?
They are, not because they're well-designed or that they run well, but because everybody is sort of bowing down to you at crosswalks and giving you a thumbs up. They're actually a little bit dangerous to drive because, especially mine, which is tricked out with Ghostbusters logos and particle throwers and Mr. Fusion and all that, people see it and end up driving off the road into a utility pole because they're pulling out their phone to try to take a picture to prove that it exists. Yeah.
And which always fascinates me about the story is because, you know, DeLorean's story didn't exactly have a happy ending.
No, you know, it didn't. But I think he was actually acquitted. and I think for entrapment, I don't know. It's fascinating. I think Hollywood is developing two or three movies about John DeLorean's story. He was an amazing fellow. You know, he designed the GTO, and there's something on pretty much every car on the road now that he designed. And I often think of the DeLorean story as being similar to the Tucker story, which I wouldn't have known about if George Lucas hadn't made a film about it. He and Francis Ford Coppola. But I don't know. I love the history of it. Everybody actually carry around little postcards that the DeLorean Motor Company folks, which an Irishman who used to be a DeLorean mechanic bought the name, and or an Englishman bought the name and reopened the DeLorean Motor Company. So now there are five or six locations all around the country, and I'm lucky enough to live close to one in Houston, so I can take my car there whenever I needed to get it fixed. But I'm thankful. John DeLorean changed my life.
Well, the name of the new novel is Armada. It is out from Crown Ernest Cline, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the new book and the previous one as well. It's a great pleasure to have you back on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. It was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Ernest Cline's new book is Armada. It is published by Crown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.